This is IBN, the Islamic Broadcasting Network. The following program is sponsored by the Islamic Media Foundation, sharing the guidance of Allah through broadcast media and the internet.
This is the best lecture series. Lessons and talks on various Islamic topics.
Today's program is Why God Created Man with Dr. Bilal Phillips.
Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala Rasulil Kareem. Wa ala alihi wa sahbihi. All praise is due to Allah, and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. The topic of this evening's lecture, Why God Created Man, is one which has certain aspects which cannot be answered, and other aspects which can be answered. What I will attempt to do is to present to you the Islamic view, how Islam answers this question. And I hope that you will take what I'm saying not in any argumentative light or seeking to put down anybody else's views, but merely to present the Islamic view as clearly as possible. In the period following the lecture, you will have ample opportunity to give your comments and to raise any questions that you would like for further clarification. Now, as I said, the question, why God created man, it could be understood as what caused God to create man, or for what purpose was man created. Now, from the point, what caused God to create man, this is the point where we say there is in fact no answer that we can give. God was not caused to create man because God has no need for which He created man. When somebody is caused to do something, they're doing something out of a need, something that needs to be fulfilled. So they're caused to do this, or they're caused to do that. Whereas in the case of God, God who is self-subsistent, who has no need for creation, we cannot say that He was caused to create man for any particular reason. So we say, in fact, nothing caused God to create man. However, what we do understand, the fact that God has described Himself as being the Creator, that the creation of man is in fact a manifestation of His attribute of being the Creator. It is a fulfillment in the sense that perfection of the quality of Creator is in creation. Just as if we were to look at it on a human level, if somebody were to tell you that they were an artist, and you ask them, well, can I see some of your works of art? And they said to you, well, I don't have any works of art. Then you would question, what kind of artist is this? He would not be considered a great artist if he has not proved or produced anything which would confirm his greatness. Of course, with regards to God, I mean, I'm putting this in human terms, it goes far beyond this. The point is that God, being the Creator, creates. That is His attribute. He has described Himself as the Creator, and that attribute is manifested in His creation. Relative to man, for what purpose was man created? This could be looked at relative to God For what purpose with regards to God was man created? For what purpose with regards to the rest of mankind was man created? And why was man created on earth with regards to the rest of the creation? With regards to other human beings, in particular, woman, because when we speak of man, mankind has two parts, males and females. God states very clearly in the Quran that He created man and woman from a single soul, and that woman and men were created to find tranquility. The term used in Arabic is sakan. You know, that they would find tranquility in each other. So with regards to females and males, their purpose is one of attaining certain tranquility in this life. With regards to other males and other females, man is created in order to obtain his needs from other men and to fulfill the needs for other men. That is, God has created man as a social being. He cannot exist by himself. He has needs which cannot be fulfilled by himself. He needs other human beings, and other human beings need him. So, he was created in this particular circumstance, amongst other human beings, to fulfill the needs that he could not fulfill by himself, and to fulfill for others similar needs. But he was created in this circumstance to live with other human beings harmoniously. And this is why you find that all of the systems which man has invented, or all of the religions which man attributes back to God, all of them call men to live harmoniously. They call them to do good to each other, to live in a way which is just, a way which encourages others to righteousness, to goodness, sharing, etc. All of the well-known values of brotherhood, you know, fraternity, equality, and all these values which we all hold dear, and which are enshrined in the various constitutions of the various countries, and also which are found in all of the various religions. With regards to the creation itself, God created man for paradise, though he is on earth. He was created to be in paradise. However, his life on this earth is one in which he would be tried and tested in order that he would grow spiritually to deserve that which he was created for, paradise. And all of the things of this world were created for man. This is stated very clearly in the Quran, that he created everything in this world for man. And as a matter of fact, any of you who have traveled in airplanes here in the kingdom, or any of the Saudi flights outside of the kingdom, you will note that in the beginning there is a prayer that is made in Arabic. On some occasions it's translated. Most of the times I've heard it, it has only been in Arabic. But that particular prayer involves certain verses from the Quran, which begin by Allah saying, سُبْحَانَ الَّذِي سَخَّرَ لَنَا هَذَا وَمَا كُنَّا لَهُ مُقْرِنِينَ. That is, glory be to He, or to the One, who has submitted for us this vehicle, whatever it is that we are traveling on, because we would not have been able to cause it to submit by ourselves. So this prayer that we make is one in which we glorify God for having submitted certain aspects of His creation in such a way that we were able to use it for our travel purposes. At the same time, though we're allowed to benefit from all of this in creation, we're not allowed to abuse the things of this creation. It is prohibited, as the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, had stated, it is prohibited for us to make animals our targets. That is, to hunt for kicks, for fun. You know, the popular practice in some parts of the world wherein people will hunt for sport purposes, not because they need to eat the meat, but because they want to bring back a trophy. You know, they'll cut off the head of the animal, stick it on their wall, or make photographs of themselves, you know, standing on the animal or whatever. But they're killing the animals for fun. This is prohibited in Islam. To take the life of an animal is only permitted if it is done so for the purpose of food, or for clothing, or to protect oneself from the harm that that animal may cause to humans. With regards to God, man was created to worship God. As is stated very clearly in the Quran, again, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ, that Allah states that He did not create the jinn who belong to the spirit world, parallel to our world, who have a choice, an ability to choose between good and evil as human beings have. And mankind, they were only created for the worship of God. Now, as I stated in the beginning, God has no needs. So when we say, or when God says that He created man for His worship, He did not create man because He needs man's worship. He created man to worship Him because man needs that worship. Just as man needs food to live, a material life, and to grow, similarly, he needs spiritual food, worship, by which to live spiritually and to grow spiritually. This is why you will oftentimes find in the Quran God speaking of those who do not worship Him as being dead. They are spiritually dead. And He speaks of those who come to that worship as coming to life. And by way of revelation, it has been made clear to us that faith and righteousness are the keys by which man may enter paradise. However, when we say that faith and righteousness are the basis, the product of worship, what we're saying, in fact, is that righteousness fundamentally depends upon God consciousness. If a person is conscious of God, aware that he has been created by God and he has a duty to God to obey His commandments, the commandments which all call man to various acts of righteousness, of living in harmony with people, of living in marital situations which are tranquil, which will bring certain spiritual and mental and physical pleasures in this life, living a life which we could call of contentment. This God consciousness, which is the key for all that, is developed fundamentally by worship. And this is why you find that Islam, there has been prescribed in it 5 times daily worship. That is, that a person's day is divided into 5 periods. And these periods all represent natural divisions of time in his life, in daily life. And the goal here is to begin each period with an act which would bring him back to the remembrance of God, so that between the periods he would be more conscious of God and thereby lead a more righteous life. So he gets up in the morning, that early morning prayer, 3:30 to 4 o'clock, not to fulfill primarily his physical needs, but to fulfill his spiritual need. He wakes up in the early morning to remember God. Then he goes to his physical needs. He eats, washes himself, etc., and he goes to work. He breaks at the midday, not again to put more food into his system, merely to keep that engine, you know, working so that he can earn more materials and improve the quality of his material life, but he breaks primarily at midday to again remember God. Since that's the purpose of his creation, then it should be reflected in his daily life. Similarly, in the afternoon, with the setting of the sun, and in the late night before going off to sleep. So his day is organized around the worship of God. And of course, this doesn't mean that a Muslim only worships 5 times a day. Of course not. One may worship as much as one feels, but the minimum. This was the minimum provided for man's worship by the last messenger of God to mankind. Now, the worship of God, the purpose of man's creation, this depends on knowing who God is. Because if one does not know who God is, then he is likely to be worshipping other than God, while thinking that he is in fact worshipping God. And this is the reality that we find when we look around the world at the various institutions and systems, cults and religions, etc. What we find in them, when you go to the essence, is that man worships the creation while believing that he is in fact worshipping God. Whether he worships an idol, and he states that this idol is a focal point for the worship of God, or he worships a man, and he says that this man was God incarnate, or he worships nature and the forces which are in nature, all of these various acts involve the worship of the creation of God and not the worship of God. We know God primarily through revelation. This is why God sends prophets to men, to mankind, to inform man of who God is, in order to clarify for them, to make that distinction between the creation of God and the Creator. As God said in the Quran, وَلَقَدْ بَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ أُمَّةٍ رَسُولًا أَنْ يَعْبُدُ اللَّهُ وَاجْتَنِبُ الطَّاغُوتِ. We have sent to every nation a messenger telling the people to worship God alone and to avoid the worship of false gods, the gods of man's creation. This is the fundamental message of the prophets. To identify who God is, to worship him, and to clarify that the gods of creation should not be worshipped, because they cannot do anything for man. Unfortunately, when we look in the various books of Revelation that are held by various systems around the world, the picture of God has been distorted grossly. In most cases, some where you may still find something of the correct descriptions of God, you will find mixed along with it many descriptions which make God like man or even less than man. Actually, it is in the Quran, the final book of Revelation of God to man, that we find a very clear picture of who God is and how should man's relationship to God be. Very clear. No ambiguity, no obscurities there. And if we reflect on the Creator of this universe, who has created it with all its complexity, we will understand that the religion which he has chosen for man, the communication that he made with man through prophets, was one containing clarity. God did not seek to confuse mankind. He did not send a message which could be understood in so many different ways that people ended up worshipping his creation instead of worshipping him. Whatever message he sent to man, it was in very clear terms. God has also given mankind an intellect, an ability to reason, in order that they may distinguish between right and wrong. Because, as I said, there are many different systems, each system claiming that their system is in fact the one true system. And if we do not use our intellect and our reason, then it will appear very confusing to us. All of these systems claiming to be correct, how can one know which in fact is correct? One may know by using one's intellect and reason. Look into the various systems. Look to see what it is they are calling you to with regards to God, in terms of righteousness and actions of piety, kindness, goodness, brotherliness, all of these things. These are available in all systems, even in the systems where God is denied. You know, even communist system, etc. People are called to treat each other gently, kindly, etc. Though the communist system, when it was implemented, may not have acted very kindly to people, but in theory, it calls to kindness and brotherhood, etc., fraternity, equality, justice, just as all of the various other religions do. So we should not look from this point of view, because this is common to all the religions. What we need to do to use our intellect and our reason is to look at the essence, at who is God in that system. If the God of the system looks like the people who brought the system or is teaching the system, then you should question right away. You know, in the case of Buddhism, if you go to Sri Lanka, you'll see Buddha looks like a Sri Lankan there. If you go to India, then Buddha there looks like an Indian. You go to China, Buddha looks like a Chinese. Japan, it looks like a Japanese. In Korea, he looks like a Korean. So, God takes the form of the people who worship him. This is a God of man's making. These are the signs. You know you are not a creator. You are creation. You are created. To elevate any individual to the level of creator is to blaspheme, is to curse God, is to speak against God. The creation is not the creator. God has given us that consciousness, that intellect, that reason, sense of reason, to reflect, to look at the various systems that are out there, and to make a judgment according to what appears to us to be correct. That intellect calls us to put aside our emotion, our feelings, our ties. See, some people will say, I could never give up the belief of my parents, my family, my people, my nation. See, this is emotion, which has clouded the intellect and the reason, and which leads people to worshipping other than God. We have to put that aside. Because if we believe that those who worship the God that we worship are going to paradise, and those who do not are going to hell, then if we think about why it is that we are worshipping the God that we worship, and we realize that this was not a choice on our part. We did not choose to be born in a particular family, to a particular set of parents in a particular area where this form of worship was taking place. This was not our choice. This is the destiny of God. Nor was the person who was born in another area worshipping another God born there out of his own choice. So if it is that God is going to put you in paradise because you were born to a family that worshipped a particular God, and put somebody else in hell because they worship another god based on the practices of their family, then this is injustice. God destines for you that you be born amongst those who worship idols or trees or whatever, and then he puts you in hell because you worship the idols and trees. This is injustice. No. God has given us an intellect and reason to reflect. His signs are available throughout our lives. Whatever it is that we are worshiping, if it's not God, there have been signs shown to us that this is not God. It is only for us to follow what we know to be correct, and we will be on the path to God. Because one who seeks the path of God, one who seeks to find God so that he may worship him, such a person will find God. This is the promise of God. The promise which was brought by the prophets of old, all the way to the last of the prophets. However, God did not only give us this intellect, this ability to reason, he also gave us a natural tendency to worship God. That is, as is stated in the Quran, when God created Adam, he took from Adam all of his descendants, and he made them bear witness that he was their Lord, and they all bore witness. And God goes on to say, so that such individuals would not be able to stand before him on the day of judgment and argue that they didn't know about this, they were not aware about God, or that it was the fault of their parents, that they're the ones who should be blamed and not them, that there would be no excuse. No one could stand before God with any excuse. He created man with a natural consciousness of God. He gave him an intellect, a sense of reason to be able to distinguish between right and wrong. He sent prophets to clarify for him who is God and who is not, and how to worship God. And he has promised the reward of paradise for those who truly worship him. And due to their worship, they were driven to do righteous deeds, to live a life of righteousness as the fulfillment or manifestation of their consciousness of God, of their worship of God. On the other hand, as is stated in the Quran, the final book of Revelation, according to the belief of Muslims, because the fundamental purpose of man's creation is to worship God, then the greatest and the only unforgivable sin is to worship other than God, is to worship others along with God or besides God. This is the greatest sin that man can commit. And because of that, one who dies in that state, because if a person does so at one stage in his life, worshipping other than God or gods besides God or along with God, but then through his searchings he finds who the true God is and leaves that worship, God will accept his choice of the correct path. God will forgive him for what went before. However, one who dies in the state of worshipping other than God, such a person will be doomed to hell. This is the ultimate destruction. This is the ultimate failure. When a person in this life does not find the purpose of his existence, he goes through life on a material plane, driven only by his animal instincts, food, clothing, shelter, sex, etc. This is all that drives him. This is what he lives for. Such a person has destroyed his life. And one for whom worship has been only a set of rituals done by my people, my family, etc. Such a one has also destroyed his life. Because ritual worship, which is not based on understanding of God, sincere worship of God, that ritual worship will not carry one to paradise either, will not give one success in this life. So, within the context of Islamic teachings, merely because one considers oneself to be a Muslim, this is no guarantee that one is going to paradise. Calling oneself a Muslim, going through certain rituals, this is not in itself, in and of itself, a guarantee of paradise. Paradise is only for those who sincerely worship God. So, whether one is within the fold of Islam, or one is outside the fold of Islam, their guidance, their success in this life, depends on finding God as He is, and worshipping Him sincerely, and acting in accordance with that worship. So in summing up, the purpose of man's creation is to worship God. God created man, He brought him into existence from nothing, and blessed him, favored him with many individual favors, as well as He submitted for him the creation around him, for his benefit. However, the benefit of this life is not the ultimate benefit. The benefit of the next life, which is the everlasting life, this is the one that we must seek most strenuously, most vigorously. And this involves our spiritual growth. Our spiritual growth, which is based in the worship of God. And that worship calls us to patience, to bearing the trials and tribulations that we find in our day-to-day lives, of treating others well, justly, not taking the rights of others, or doing any forms of injustice to them. Such a life is the fulfillment of the purpose of man's creation. And as such, God has promised him paradise from which he was originally created. I will stop at this point, because the goal of this lecture was really just to give you some food for thought, to express to you something of the Islamic view with relationship to the creation of man and man's purpose in life, in order that it would stimulate amongst you some discussion, that you may find out some more about what Islam is. It is the destiny of God that you are here. You made your plans to come here for material gain. The vast majority of you who are here, you came here for material gain, to gain something material out of this period of time that you spend here. However, there is something else here for you, something which you should reflect on, and that is the way of life that is the foundation of this nation. That way of life which is shared by over 1 billion people around the world, which has a book of Revelation, which is available if you would like to read it. And it has a set of teachings which govern all aspects of human life. So, it being the destiny of God that you are here, we would hope that you would take whatever opportunities are made available to you to investigate, to find out what Islam teaches, what is its essence, what are its practices, what do they mean, in order that you may have an understanding and be able to make a reasoned judgment with regards to Islam. So, I will now turn over the floor to you all. And those of you that have questions which are written, you would not prefer to stand up and express them yourself. And I would like to say that in this gathering, because the primary purpose was to convey something of the message of Islam to our non-Muslim guests, I would like to give the first opportunity to them to express their comments or to share some ideas or to ask some questions. So I would like to ask our Muslim brothers who are here to refrain. I know in your enthusiasm, you oftentimes tend to monopolize the question and answer periods of lectures. So I'm asking you to just refrain yourself and allow our non-Muslim guests to get a chance to ask whatever they would like to ask.
Okay, thank you, Sheikh Bilal. And Allah bless you, and we hope that everyone who's taking time to come out here this evening will learn and benefit from what you just said. There is a question that, something that you might need to, that someone asked you to elaborate on, and that is the concept of worship in Islam. Is this, are you speaking here of rituals, or does the concept of worship in Islam something much wider than just rituals as we might see in other religions?
Well, I did clarify that it is not the ritual in and of itself, but the sincere belief and sincere commitment to God, which constitutes the essence of worship, and that sincere belief and commitment be manifest in righteous actions. When we look at the system of Islam, what we call the pillars of Islam, whether it be prayer, daily prayer, or it be the fasting in the month of Ramadan, or the giving of charity, or the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, we see in all of these various acts a call to righteousness. All of these acts, when done according to the spirit of the acts, they help us to be more righteous individuals. And this is why I would say that it is not just a question of ritual, because in Islam there is ritual. However, the spirit of the various rituals have been clearly explained by the Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, in order that these rituals not become meaningless physical acts which are devoid of sincere belief and true worship.
Following question says, what is your idea from the Christian point of view that God was created in the image or likeness of man?
Man was created in the image or likeness of God.
Man was created in the image and likeness of God.
This statement, which is found in Genesis, has led much of Christendom to portray God in the likeness of man. And it has also opened the door for the idea of accepting that some men or a man may actually be God. The Islamic view is that man was created with some of the attributes of God on a finite level. Not in their perfection. God's love is infinite. Man is created also with the attribute of the capacity to love. So there is a likeness here. However, that likeness is only in the concept of love in a general sense. But when it comes to the actual attribute of love which is possessed by God, man cannot possess that attribute. And so on through all of the various attributes of God. That there is, man is in a likeness, there is something similar in the sense that he shares attributes which are also held by God, but they are on a limited scale. And this is why God states very clearly in the Quran, لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ, that there is nothing like unto him. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٍ, and none is similar to him. So, this is denying that man could at anywhere or at any time have the attributes of God, or that God has any of the attributes of men. So, the correct view, which was maintained within the teachings of the prophets of old, Moses, etc., wherein man was prohibited from taking any likeness, from giving any likeness to God. This view is maintained very firmly in Islam. God is not conceived in the mind, because whatever we conceive is from what we have perceived, and God is beyond our perception. And whatever we perceive is from the things which are created, and God is not from the creation. He is the creator. So, the view of Islam is that God did not create man in his likeness in the sense that God looks like a man, but that God created in man attributes which had a limited similarity to the attributes of God. Before we take a question, we said that we have our non-Muslim guests, quite a few here. This is your opportunity. Please, you have a question, come and ask something.
Love.
God, love. That we love other human beings and we love God. Sure. Yes. Have some?
Yes.
About pets? If having a pet means taking an animal which lives freely in the wild and forcing it into a circumstance, you know, which is like putting it in a prison, you know, such an act would not be liked in Islam. You know, the idea of taking a bird which flies freely and chaining it to a stick or putting it in a cage, now this is not something which is preferred by Islam. That bird live freely in the wild, and it should be allowed to live a natural and normal life. Of course, as I said, it's not prohibited. I mean, unless you are actually causing physical harm to the bird, you know, where you may be cutting its wings or things like this. You know, people do different things to animals to keep them domesticated or keep them under their control. It's not prohibited in that sense, but it would be disliked. Now, there are some animals which have been particularly prohibited for us to keep as pets. And the animal in specifically is the dog. And I think probably this is what you are referring to. The dog, which in Western society or other societies is looked at as man's best friend, in Islam is not recommended to be kept as a pet. In fact, it is considered harmful to yourself from a religious point of view to keep a dog as a pet. However, if the dog is kept for particular purposes, because again, Islam recognizes the need for dogs in some circumstances. A dog which is a watchdog, a dog which is a sheepdog, a dog which will herd cattle or whatever, a hunting dog, you go hunting with, it will catch the animal that you shoot or whatever and bring it back. Keeping such animals, training them, etc., this is permitted. But taking the dog into your home like you would your child, sleeping with the dog, and, you know, making the dog, you see where people have gone to extremes with the dog. You see pictures of people kissing the dogs, people making clothes for dogs. You know, you have people who will die and leave all their will to their dog. You know, they'll cut off their families and so on, leave everything to their dog. This kind of, you know, excessive love, where people will allow other people to starve in the society, to live a dog's life, and yet elevate a dog, you know, to that of the status of a human being, where he's given, you know, the best of food, etc., etc. This is sort of like a slap in the face of humanity. You will find societies, you know, for the protection of dogs or animals, especially dogs, where people will, you know, go to great lengths for the protection of the dog. But the lives of human beings, which are being destroyed in various parts of the world, don't mean that much to them. The dog becomes even more important than the human beings. So, Islam recognizes the keeping of a dog for a particular need, material need, but it prohibits the keeping of a dog as merely as a pet. Not just because of the tendency of man to go overboard in his love of the dog, but also because there is some harm in that dog itself. Because we have been instructed in Islam that if a dog licks or drinks from a vessel which you are eating from, that this vessel, the contents should be poured out, given to the dog to finish eating, and that vessel should be cleaned 7 times. One of those times, clean earth should be used. This is particular instructions which are given by the Prophet with regards to it, which indicates to us that there is some harm in the saliva or products which are produced by the, you know, by the dog, which will come out in his saliva or whatever. And there is some harm there. And in order to protect man from that, this instruction has been given. But pets in the form of, for example, horses, which are, you know, which are domesticated animals anyway, they've been domesticated, using them for riding purposes, etc. I mean, Islam doesn't hold any prohibition or dislike for the keeping of such animals, especially because of the fact that they help in developing good physical qualities in human beings, the riding, etc. This is good for health-wise, etc.
Okay, so we'll now take some of the written questions.
You hear in the news reference to Shiite Muslims or Muslims, sometimes it's written like this, and Sunni Muslims. These are the main two groups that are mentioned in the news in this fashion. To understand the difference between the two groups, one has to understand the fundamental concept of God as taught in the Quran and in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him. And this concept is one which I have spoken about in the lecture, wherein the attributes of God are not shared with His creation in any way. Those complete and perfect attributes are not shared with His creation. And whoever seeks to share these attributes with the creation, we consider that person to have deviated from the main body of Islam. The vast majority of Muslims, 90% of them, fall under the general category of Sunni or Sunnite Muslims. We could call this the Orthodox Muslims. Those who maintain this basic concept that the attributes of God are not shared by man. What we find in the teachings, which are referred to as the Shiite Muslim teachings, is that some of the attributes of God have been given to some individuals. These individuals
are particular descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. May God's peace and blessings be upon him. They have assigned to a certain number of his descendants, 11 in number, the 12th one being the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. May God's peace and blessings be upon him. They have assigned to this group of 12, 11 descendants and one relative, attributes of one, infallibility, being incapable of doing any error, making any mistake, whether inwardly or outwardly, deliberately or accidentally, an infallibility which goes beyond even that of Catholicism. Catholics who believe that when the Pope is inaugurated, when he becomes the Pope, then he becomes infallible. Prior to that, he was a fallible human being. But after he becomes the Pope, then he becomes infallible with regards to his religious rulings, in spite of the fact that different popes will cancel the rulings of other popes. But for Shiite Muslims, they hold that these descendants of the Prophet were infallible. And because of that, they are the ones who should have led the Muslim nation. Because if they're infallible and capable of doing any error, that is the leader who you want. If you can have somebody who will not make any mistakes, well, this is your best leader. But of course, from the Orthodox point of view, all human beings make mistakes. Even the prophets of God made mistakes. However, their mistakes were not on the level of the average human beings' mistakes. They did not make mistakes which were gross mistakes which involved, you know, corruption, as they are portrayed, for example, in the Old Testament as, you know, committing incest, you know, with their daughters and having children and, you know, lusting after wives of men and committing adultery and, you know, these kind of gross errors. These we do not believe can be attributed to the Prophet. However, mistakes in judgment, yes. However, whenever a Prophet made a mistake in judgment, that is choosing the good over the better, God would correct the Prophet, and that choice would become a lesson and an example and a teaching for the followers. And that's why you can find in the Quran certain verses in which God has corrected Prophet Muhammad when he made certain choices which were not the better choice. So human beings who are not prophets do not have the benefit of revelation to correct them. Therefore, according to the Orthodox view, we choose our leaders. There is nobody who has the divine right to lead, which is a basis of the Shiite philosophy, that these 12 individuals had the divine right to lead because they were infallible. Furthermore, they attribute to these individuals omniscience, that is, knowledge of all things. And they have in their books statements that these individuals knew the past, the present, and the future. Their knowledge was unbounded. We believe this kind of knowledge belongs only to God. No human being knows the past, present, and future. Only God knows this. They also attribute to them omnipotence, power over all phases of creation, that the atoms of creation are submitted to them, and so on. And as such, you find in the course of their worship, they direct prayers to these individuals. They consider them capable of answering their prayers. And all of that is abhorrent to mainstream Islam. So they represent a deviation from the main body of beliefs. A deviation which may be similar, for example, to, in Christianity, to certain groups like the Mormons, you know, who claim that their leader, Smith, received revelation, you know, a special book written on golden tablets, etc. And, you know, he has built a religion out of it, considers himself Christian, etc., their followers, However, the main body of Christianity look at them as being deviants, having deviated. And any system, no matter how perfect it may be, will have individuals who will break off, who choose to follow their own desires or interpretations, which are not consistent with the teachings which the prophets themselves brought. Thank you.
Some of these questions are actually asked by certain people. They go together. Let me read this in two parts. Number one, can a man who worships Allah but is not a Muslim, can a man worship Allah sincerely without being a Muslim? That is related to two other questions I have here that says, if a person obeys God sincerely but has no particular belief, will he go to paradise?
A person who has not been exposed, we're talking about now the point of view of Islam. A person who is not exposed to the final message of God to man, Islam, properly in its proper form, etc. If such a person, wherever he may be, rejects the false teachings in whatever system he may find himself, and seeks to worship God alone, then his affair is with God. His affair is with God. God will judge him according to the knowledge which was available to him. And God is the most just. However, if a person who belongs to one of the various systems that are out there hears the message of Islam, what is Islam? And in hearing it, they realize, of course, that what they believe was very similar to what Islam believes. However, they choose not to accept Islam. Then, according to the teachings of Islam, such a person will go to hell. As the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, said, that whoever hears about me, that is, hears about the Prophet and his message that he brought properly, and does not believe in me, such will not enter paradise. Because those people who have rejected the falsities of their religion and have come to a basic and pure foundation of belief, they will find that everything that Islam has to offer supports that system of belief. It strengthens it and helps it. So one would then ask the question, why would you not become a Muslim? Why would you then not declare your faith and accept the system in its completeness as bought by the last of the prophets? When a person is asked this question, you will find, generally speaking, that they have chosen not to accept the faith because of certain emotional issues. It might be family. If my wife found out that I became a Muslim, she would divorce me. So that individual's love for his wife is greater than his love for God. So she becomes an object of worship for him, really. Because from the Islamic point of view, true worship involves loving God more than all else in creation. Not doing anything which is displeasing to God, though it may please every human being on the earth. But doing everything which is pleasing to God, though it may displease every human being on the earth. This is true faith and true worship. So, those people who have arrived at the oneness of God, the uniqueness of God, and they realize that it is only in Islam that that oneness and uniqueness is echoed and its purity, but yet reject that, then they have been promised hell. Because they have knowledge, but they have not acted in accordance with that knowledge. Thank you. Subhanakallahu wa hamdaka nashhadu wa la ilaha illa anta nastaghfiruka.
This program has been sponsored by the Islamic Media Foundation, sharing the guidance of Allah through broadcast media and the internet.